Welcome, everyone. This deep dive is specifically for folks in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena. We're digging into something really crucial for our communities, making our local streets safer.
Yeah, it's a big topic.
It is. And, you know, you often hear about car crashes boiling down to just who made a mistake, right? Mm-hmm. But what if there's more to it?
Mm-hmm.
Our source today, this report called Beyond Blame, argues exactly that. It suggests that often it's really about how our streets themselves are designed.
That's the core idea, yeah. And this isn't just theory. The report actually looks at real crashes, dissects them to find these underlying factors going beyond just the immediate cause. It's about understanding the whole system.
Right, the system.
Mm-hmm.
So our goal here, our mission for this deep dive, is to pull out the key insights from this report. We want to arm you, our listeners in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, with knowledge about how we can proactively push for safer streets right here.
Sounds good.
Okay, let's jump in. The report kicks off with this idea, the problem with blame. What's the typical approach when there's a crash?
Well, usually the focus immediately goes to figuring out fault.
Yeah.
You know, police reports get written mainly for legal reasons, insurance claims.
Assigning responsibility.
Exactly. And while that's needed for those processes, the report contrasts this with how, say, other fields handle serious incidents.
Oh, like you see in medicine or aviation, with things like mortality reviews or NTSB investigations for plane crashes.
Precisely. In those fields, the main goal isn't blame, it's learning. They do these really thorough analyses to understand all the contributing factors, why, to prevent it from happening again.
So it's about systemic learning, not just individual fault.
That's it.
And that's really the heart of Beyond Blame, isn't it? This idea that every fatal crash isn't just, you know, a tragedy caused by one person messing up.
Right.
But it's actually a chance to learn something to improve the system.
Exactly. The report argues pretty strongly that each fatal crash holds these important lessons that go way beyond just who did what wrong. If we shift our focus from blame to really understanding everything that played a role,
then we can start making real progress on safety.
That's the hope. Genuine progress.
Okay, so what were some of these factors, these less obvious things that kept showing up in the crashes they looked at?
Well, they did these things called crash analysis studio sessions, the first 18 of them. Experts looked at crash data, photos, videos,
mm-hmm.
and five recurring themes, five factors really jumped out. And these are super relevant, I think, for us to think about in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Okay, let's get into those five. The first one they list is high-speed road design in urban areas. That sounds pretty relevant for some of our streets. What does that mean exactly?
Okay, so think about it like this. A high-speed roadway isn't just I-45. It's any street designed in a way that encourages speeds over, say, 30 miles per hour.
Okay.
Now, picture an urban area. You know, our neighborhoods, downtown areas in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, places with shops, homes, people walking, maybe biking.
Lots of activity, complexity.
Right. And the problem the report highlights is when we design roads that feel like highways, right smack in the middle of where all this complex life is happening.
So we've got roads built for speed cutting through places where people are.
That's the crux of it. The report points out how design elements like really wide lanes, shoulders, maybe long turn lanes, these clear zones on the side, stuff borrowed from highway design.
Mm-hmm.
They give drivers this feeling of having a large margin of safety. And what do people tend to do when they feel safer behind the wheel?
Speed up.
Yeah.
Even if the sign says 35, the road feels like 50. The report had examples of that, didn't it? Where
yeah.
the actual driving speed was way higher than the limit.
Oh, yeah. Big time. In Hyattsville, Maryland, the 85th percentile speed, that's the speed most drivers are actually going at or below, was 30% higher than the posted limit.
30%. Wow.
In Amarillo, Texas, it was 15% higher. So this isn't just, you know, a few outliers. It's how people naturally respond to the design.
And why is that extra speed so dangerous in our local urban spots?
It comes down to what the report calls random complexity. You've got pedestrians maybe stepping out, cyclists, cars turning unexpectedly.
Kids.
Kids, exactly. Higher speeds drastically cut your reaction time. And they massively increase the distance you need to stop. There's NHTSA data in the report. At 50 mile an hour, a car travels 110 feet before the driver even starts to hit the brakes.
Whoa, 110 feet just for reaction time at 50. That really frames how little room for error there is when you're sharing space in town.
It really does. And the report is clear. This isn't necessarily about blaming drivers for being reckless. It's often a fundamental design mismatch. We've built highway-like roads where people are trying to live their lives.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
The second factor they found was design that inadequately accounts for people walking and biking. feels closely related to the speed issue.
Very much so. Even in places where everyone knows people walk and bike, like near our homes, local shops, schools, parks, right here, the street design still often prioritizes moving cars quickly.
The safety of pedestrians, cyclists, kind of takes a back seat.
Often, yeah. Or it's just not given enough weight. Especially when speeds are higher, that margin for error for someone not in a vehicle is tiny.
So what does the report say helps there? Slower speeds, obviously.
Definitely slower speeds. But also reducing the amount of time pedestrians and cyclists are exposed to traffic, like making crossing distances shorter. And ideally, physical separation, like protected bike lanes or wider sidewalks, especially if speeds are going to be over, say, 20 monorail.
They used that example from Meridian, Idaho, didn't they? The death of Terry Binder near his school. That was powerful.
It really illustrates the point. Here's a place with known pedestrian activity kids going to school. Yet the road design encouraged an 85th percentile speed of 44 mph.
44 near a school zone crossing.
And Terry, using the crosswalk, was estimated to be exposed to that fast traffic for 33 seconds. That's a long time to be vulnerable. The design just didn't adequately account for the people it knew would be there.
Heartbreaking. Okay, factor number three, dangerous intersection design. Intersections are always tricky spots, aren't they?
Inherently, yes, you've got conflicting movements. But the design can either clearly signal that risk to drivers, make them more cautious, or it can actually create a false sense of security.
Make it seem safer than it is.
Exactly. The report found cases where the design seemed to almost encourage drivers to maintain or even increase speed as they approached the intersection.
The Richmond, Virginia example, Murat Khan's death, seemed to illustrate that.
Yes, it showed how multiple things can stack up. One-way traffic, wide lanes making it feel open, maybe really long green light times encouraging people to punch it.
Uh-huh.
And then things like wide corners, those big sweeping curb radii, which increase the crossing distance for pedestrians. And this was in an area with lots of students, people on foot.
Yeah. And it was a key point in the report about intersections and speed, wasn't there? Something about a threshold.
Yes, a really crucial one. It basically says that once vehicle speeds at an intersection get above 20 mph, it becomes incredibly difficult, maybe impossible, to design it in a way that consistently protects against common human errors leading to severe crashes.
20 miles per hour. That's pretty slow. That really challenges how we think about a lot of our intersections.
It does. It suggests a fundamental need to slow traffic down where conflicts are likely.
Okay, the fourth factor, visibility and lighting issues. I feel like anyone who walks or bikes around Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena, especially at dusk or night, has probably felt this one.
Very likely. The report found that street lighting is often designed with the primary goal of helping drivers see other cars.
Right.
That the specific needs of pedestrians and cyclists making them visible aren't always fully considered. Sometimes the way the lights are positioned can actually create glare for drivers or deep shadows where people on foot or bike can just disappear.
That Hyattsville, Maryland example with Helen Jorgensen, that was chilling. She was in a marked crosswalk.
Yeah.
She probably felt visible, right?
You'd assume so. Marked crossing, maybe street lights on. But the report suggested the way the vehicle's headlights interacted with the ambient lighting and the crosswalk markings actually cast shadows that made her effectively invisible to the driver.
Wow. So even with lights and markings, the design failed her.
It's a stark reminder that lighting needs to serve everyone using the road, not just drivers seeing other cars. What looks okay from behind the wheel might be a death trap for someone else.
Definitely. Okay, the fifth and final recurring factor. Deviation from the designer's intent. This one's interesting. It's about things changing after the road was initially planned or built.
Exactly. Sometimes a street is designed pretty well on paper, with safety in mind, but then changes happen, maybe during construction, maybe years later due to maintenance or adding something new like a bus stop.
Mm-hmm.
These changes can be intentional or unintentional, but they can introduce new safety problems the original designer never anticipated. And the issue is, while cities often check how changes affect car traffic flow,
like will it cause backups?
Right. They don't always do the same level of follow-up to see how those changes impact pedestrian or bicycle safety.
The example from Huntsville, Alabama with Joshua Gurley seemed to fit this perfectly.
Yes. They modified a sidewalk area, probably with good intentions, to put in a bus shelter. But the way they did it unintentionally created confusion and made it much harder and more dangerous for cyclists who were trying to use that same area to cross the road.
So a seemingly small change had big, unforeseen safety consequences for cyclists.
Precisely. These little deviations can really add up.
Okay, so those are the five big recurring problems the report identified. High-speed design in urban areas, not accounting for walkers and bikers, dangerous intersections, lighting issues, and these deviations from the plan. So what does the report say we can do about it? What can our local leaders in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, roughly, you know, take action on?
Good question. The report lays out six key recommendations. Think of them as concrete steps to shift from just reacting to crashes towards proactively building safer streets for all of us right here.
Okay, let's hear them. What's the first one?
First is make safety a core organizational responsibility. This sounds a bit bureaucratic, but it's crucial. It means the person or the team responsible for traffic safety needs real authority.
What does real authority look like in this context? Not just a title.
Not just a title, no. It means having a real say in the design process. Having the power to, potentially, veto designs that are clearly unsafe. It means having direct access to the top decision makers, reporting directly to elected officials, and needing to sign off on transportation plans before they go out to bid.
So they can actually influence things before problems get built.
Exactly. The report uses an example from Charlotte, North Carolina, where they committed money to safety. But because the safety staff didn't have this kind of authority, the money didn't translate into actual safety improvements on the ground. Power matters.
Okay, makes sense. Recommendation two, establish a crash response team. Who's on this team and what do they do?
This team should ideally be a mix of experts, traffic safety engineers, maybe urban designers, planners.
Great.
Their job right after a serious or fatal crash isn't blame, it's data collection. They need to get to the site quickly, gather detailed information, make observations. And crucially, the report says they should try to experience the location as the people involved in the crash did. Walk the path, bike the route, see it from that perspective.
Really get that ground level understanding.
Uh-huh.
Okay. And the third recommendation builds on that. Establish a crash analysis studio. What's a crash analysis studio?
Think of it like those medical mortality conferences we mentioned earlier. It's a formal, structured meeting.
Uh-huh.
The crash response team presents what they found at the scene.
Uh-huh.
Then a facilitator leads a discussion. And here's the key part. It's not just the technical experts in the room. It also includes non-technical folks, what the report calls neighborhood experts.
People who actually live there, work there, use that street every day.
Exactly. People from Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena, who know that specific intersection or stretch of road intimately. Their insights are incredibly valuable because they see things the technical experts might miss. They know the near misses, the usual behaviors.
That makes a lot of sense. So what's the goal of this studio meeting?
The goal is collaborative problem solving. First, identify all the contributing factors, the design, the conditions, everything. Then brainstorm potential solutions. These could be immediate quick fixes, near-term adjustments, or bigger long-term changes.
Okay. Now, the fourth recommendation sounds like it addresses those immediate fixes. Use temporary traffic control devices to respond quickly. What are we talking about here? Cones and barrels.
Basically, yes. It's about using the same tools we already use for construction zones. Cones, flexible posts, bollards, temporary paint, signs to quickly address a known safety hazard. Or even just to test a potential change, like narrowing lanes or creating a temporary pedestrian refuge.
Oh, so you can try things out without a huge permanent project right away.
Precisely. The report stresses this is a proven, relatively inexpensive way to potentially save lives now and also gather real-world data on how a change works before you commit to concrete. We don't always have to wait years for a big redesign.
That sounds really practical for our local public works departments.
Yeah.
Okay, number five gets into the longer-term view. Update local street standards to prioritize safety.
Right. This is about looking at the actual rule books, the design manuals that our cities use, especially if, like many places, we've adopted standards that lead to those high-speed designs in urban areas we talked about.
So changing the default settings, basically.
Kind of, yeah. The report pushes this idea of distinguishing between roads and streets. Think of a road like a highway. Its main job is moving vehicles fast between places, limited access. A street, though, is different. Our main streets, our neighborhood streets in Pasadena or LaPorte, they're platforms for community life, for businesses, for homes.
They're places, not just conduits.
Exactly. And the report argues we've often treated our streets like roads, focusing too much on speed and volume instead of the safety and quality of the place. Ideally, streets in complex areas where people are actively present shouldn't be designed for speeds over 20 miles per hour.
20, again. That's a recurring theme. Okay, last recommendation, number six. Conduct bike and walk audits for all projects. What does that involve?
This means the design team, the engineers, the planners needs to physically get out there and experience the project area as if they were a pedestrian or a cyclist.
Put themselves in their shoes, literally.
Literally. And they need to do it before construction starts to understand the existing conditions and after the project is finished to see if the design actually works safely in reality, not just on the plans.
Validate the assumptions.
Right. And it's crucial, the report says, to include diverse perspectives in these audits. People with disabilities, older adults, parents with strollers, making sure the design works for everyone in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena.
Those six recommendations together, safety responsibility, response teams, analysis studios, temporary fixes, updated standards, and walk bike audits, that feels like a solid roadmap.
It's a comprehensive approach, yeah.
And the report shared some examples of this crash analysis studio actually working in practice, right? It
Yeah,
helps to see how it plays out.
definitely. They mentioned places like Hyattsville, Amarillo, Denver using it. The Indianapolis example was striking. A cyclist was killed where a trail crossed a big, fast road, what the report calls a strode, you know, that mix of street and road.
Right. Dangerous combo.
The studio identified the design flaws, and it actually led to something called the Community Powered Infrastructure Initiative. It empowers residents themselves to make some of those quick, temporary safety improvements.
Wow. Directly involving the community in the fix. That's powerful. What about Huntsville, Alabama?
Huntsville had a string of pedestrian and cyclist deaths on this road, University Drive, that was built like a highway but ran through an area with businesses and apartments. The studio process there led to recommendations for things like better visibility, trying out narrower lanes, adding a pedestrian refuge island, even as temporary measures to start.
Making immediate, if interim, improvements.
Exactly. Start making it safer now.
And the Rochester, New York case showed how even places that look okay on the surface can have hidden issues.
Yeah, that was interesting. A pedestrian and his dog were killed at an intersection that, at first glance, seemed reasonably safe. But the studio dug deeper. They found issues like lots of cut-through traffic from nearby highways using local streets, speeding problems, old curb ramps that weren't ADA compliant, poor lighting.
Stuff you might not notice just driving through.
Right. And that led to recommendations like lower speed limits, testing out narrower road configurations, and upgrading the lights and crosswalks. The encouraging part there was that city officials were actively part of the studio and were committed to making the changes.
It's really good to hear about these places actually using this process and seeing results. Now, one thing that probably comes up for city leaders, maybe even here locally, is liability. If we start talking openly about safety problems, design flaws, does that open the city up to lawsuits?
That's a common and understandable concern. The report tackles it head-on with three main counterarguments. First, depending on the state and leaders here in Deer Park, LaPorte, Pasadena should definitely check with their city attorneys about Texas law. There are often legal limits on municipal liability for crashes, sometimes even specific immunities.
Okay, so there might be legal protections already in place.
Potentially, yes. Second, the report argues that being proactive, actively looking for and fixing safety issues is actually the best defense against claims of negligence. It shows the city is doing its job. Ignoring problems is arguably riskier legally.
Right, being proactive versus reactive. What's the third point?
The third point is really an ethical one. Is the fear of a potential lawsuit more important than preventing injuries and deaths in our community? The report argues that the fundamental duty of local government is to protect its residents. That ethical imperative to save lives should outweigh concerns about liability.
That's a powerful point. Hard to argue with the ethics of saving lives. Okay, so bringing this all back home for our listeners in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, what's the big takeaway message from this beyond blame approach?
I think the main thing is that making our streets safer isn't just about telling drivers to be more careful, although that's always important. It's fundamentally about acknowledging the huge role that design plays.
How the streets themselves are built.
Exactly. And by adopting this beyond blame mindset, by learning from crashes instead of just assigning fault, and by proactively using the kinds of recommendations we talked about, the response teams, the studios, the temporary fixes, updating standards, our communities right here do have the power to make things safer. For drivers, yes, but especially for people walking and biking. It's about taking action locally.
Yeah, moving beyond blame really does seem to open the door for practical improvements in our own neighborhoods. So maybe a final thought for everyone listening. As you're out and about in Deer Park, LaPorte, or Pasadena today or this week, take a look around. Notice the intersections, the street designs. Do any of them remind you of the issues we discussed?
Good exercise.
And maybe think about what small steps inspired by those temporary fixes, maybe, or getting involved locally, could start making a difference right where you live. And hey, if you find these deep dives into local issues valuable and want to help us keep bringing this kind of information to our community, please consider supporting our work. You can find a link at thinkadactlocally.com/donate. It's also in the show notes.